guys. Welcome to day two of Halloween Eek Week. These are my special Halloween week movie reviews, doing just little extra ones, more than I would normally do. Like, I don't make enough work for myself. But, you know, these were movies that I kind of picked because these are movies that sort of give me like a Halloween-y kind of vibe, even though the ones more toward the end of the week, I'm going to go more toward kind of more straightforward, like Halloween type stuff, like movies that are set at Halloween and stuff. But prior to that, I kind of wanted to get into more things that just gave me the Halloween vibe. And mainly I get that from older movies, classic movies. I got a couple newer ones toward the end of the week, but it's been way too long for me to get around to this one because, much like I was talking about when I reviewed The Haunting from 1963, which is one of my favorite horror movies of all time, easily my favorite haunted house movie, and this one from a couple of years prior, easily one of the best ghost stories ever made. I mean, I don't really think anyone's going to argue with me on that score. I mean, I'm sure they will because it's the internet, but you know what I mean. But I'm just saying, this is pretty widely acknowledged as a classic, and this is, of course, 1961's The Innocents. And I was so, so happy. This is a very cheap DVD release. I just kind of got it on Amazon. It's not even in like widescreen really, and it's just kind of pan and scan, which kind of sucks because it was shot in CinemaScope. But and this also does not have any special features on it. I think all it's on there is the trailer. But I just needed it for the show. I wanted to rewatch it. I've seen it several times prior to this, and I just wanted to revisit it for the show because I love this movie. It has pretty much everything I really like about horror movies. It has like a gothic vibe to it. It's you know, it's old black and white. It's kind of like has beautiful cinematography, and it's also kind of a haunted house or a ghost story, and I love those. And it also has that whole ambiguity thing, which The Haunting has too, where you're not entirely sure whether the haunting is genuine, as in actually happening in the real world, or perhaps we're seeing things subjectively from essentially an unreliable narrator. Now, obviously, I'm sure pretty much everybody in the world knows this at this point, but The Innocents was a adaptation. It's actually an adaptation of a stage play by William Archibald, which, of course, was based on the classic Henry James novella, The Turn of the Screw. Now, I kind of feel like lately, well, in the past couple years anyway, Turn of the Screw has kind of seen a little bit of a resurgence. You know, they made that movie, The Turning, in that was early 2019, I think, which, was pretty good until that stupid ending where all ambiguity was just flung out the window, where ambiguity was kind of the thing that I always liked about the original novella and about this adaptation of it. Also, of course, Netflix did Haunting of Bly Manor, you know, the second season of Haunting of Hill House, even though it's a completely different story. So, like I said, Haunting, The Innocents, these kind of two go together, even though, I mean, you know, they're not really the same story. It's just that they have, like, some of the same themes going on in them, which I think is why people kind of associate them with one another. But, yeah, Haunting of Bly Manor was, you know, obviously a large expansion of the story, just like he did with Haunting of Hill House, you know, the first season. Mike Flanagan kind of, like, took the germ of the story from Henry James's novella and expanded it out into series length. Now, like I said, there have been several other adaptations of Turn of the Screw. I think there were some done for, like, British television, you know, so it's been done a lot of times, and it's easy to see why, because it's just a really, I mean, the same way that Haunting of Hill House is, it's a great, the best ghost stories, I feel like, are these ambiguous ones where, or at least ones where you also, where the ghost story or the haunting kind of ties in directly with like the psychological states of the person that are people that are witnessing the ghosts. And I think that's why these stories kind of like resonate across the ages and why they get like reinterpreted with pretty much every new generation. Although, I haven't seen every single adaptation of The Turn of the Screw, but I think 99% of horror fans and movie critics would agree that this 1961 one, directed by Jack Clayton, easily the best one. Now, what ended up happening with this one? As I said, this one was actually more directly based on the stage play, which is a pretty faithful adaptation. But now, it's been a while since I read The Turn of the Screw, but the novella does leave it ambiguous as to whether the ghosts exist or whether it's all in the governess's mind, although it leans more toward the haunting being real. The stage play pretty much comes down on the side of the ghost being real. And so when William Archibald wrote the original screenplay for the movie, Jack Clayton, who was produced and directed the film, he was kind of like, I don't really like that. I don't want to take a stand on it, essentially, one way or the other. I want to leave it up to the audience whether they think the ghosts are real or whether they think the governess, Miss Giddens, is just imagining everything or projecting. So basically, he brought in the very famous Truman Capote, who took a break out of writing In Cold Blood, his most famous book ever, probably one of the most famous, easily one of the most famous true crime books ever written. He took 3 weeks off, and he was a big fan of the Henry James novella, so he said, well, okay, I'll revamp the script for you and kind of make it more ambiguous and put more of like a psychological spin on it. So, and it's interesting that he did that because, I mean, and I feel like the novella too, but this interpretation of it, this movie adaptation of it, has easily drawn the most like critical analysis in the sense that so much stuff could be going on in this, and there's really no wrong answer, because whatever interpretation that you want to bring to it, you can find evidence of that interpretation, you know. So it's interesting to watch it, to rewatch it with different interpretations of it in mind. And I think that it just struck this perfect balance of however you want to read it. Yes, the ghosts are real, or no, she's imagining it, and all this other kind of subtext that's going on in there too. You can read it like that and it would be like totally legitimate. And that's why I don't think it's ever going to be solved, because I don't think there is anything to be solved. Just such a great screenplay and just such a great film, because you can just read it in many different ways and no one is really wrong, because you can find evidence to support pretty much any interpretation that you want to come up with. So I feel like most people probably know the story, but if you don't, I'll get a little bit into it. So in this, Deborah Carr plays a governess named Miss Giddens. Now, interestingly, I thought this, and this kind of gave the movie, this interpretation of it, a little bit of a different dynamic. In the original novella, Miss Giddens is only 20 years old. And this is her first governess job. So she's, you know, she's kind of portrayed as like a little bit naive, a little bit sheltered, that type of thing. Now, in this, Deborah Carr was actually 40 years old when she was offered this role, which kind of gives her character in a little bit of a different thing going on, because she does say that this is her first governess job. But even though she's older, but I think it was like the right idea to leave her backstory a little bit ambiguous, because you're not really sure. She does say, like, at the beginning, like when she's at the interview for the job, that, you know, her dad was like a country parson, and she says something to the kids like later on about how no one had secrets in their house, or their house was very small and they all had to be quiet because their dad was always working on sermons. So there's some things that are kind of implied, but they never really go into like what Miss Giddens was doing like prior to her working as a governess. Like, she said this is her first governess job and she's not experienced in it. So, which leads, you know, she's 40 years old. What was she doing before? Was she married before? Is she widowed? Did she have children? And they really don't go into it. And I think that makes it a lot more intriguing, because as I said, any interpretation you want to bring to this, you can kind of read different things into it. So I think that was a lot of that was Truman Capote's influence, where he's just like, we're going to take out everything that's, you know, concrete about everyone's backstory. We're not going to show any flashbacks or anything like that, because I think the original play did have flashbacks that showed, you know, Peter Quint and Miss Jessel, who was the initial, you know, the original governess, that showed them alive. And he took all that out. And I think that that was a really wise decision. So Miss Giddens, in the first scene, she's at a job interview, and I've seen this compared. Stanley Kubrick must have seen this film or been a fan of this film, because this film is structured, if you think about it, very much like The Shining. You know, I'm not going to get too much into it, because that's not really like the scope of the video, but it's kind of like I've seen other videos like pointing this out where you can just kind of like map the, you know, the kind of plot points and everything like that in The Shining. And it's very kind of similar. So she's at an interview. The guy she's interviewing with is this very, very wealthy man. And he basically says, yeah, I have this niece and nephew and they're orphaned. And he basically just comes right out and says, look, I live here in London. I like my life here. And it's no place for children. And I basically can't be bothered. He says, I don't have any room in my life mentally or emotionally or physically or anything like that for these children. So basically, I just need somebody that's going to be a governess and that's just going to take over the whole house and take care of them and not bother me with anything. And basically, he says that to her straight up, like at the very beginning of the movie. You know, I can't be bothered with these kids. It's not my thing. And I don't want to be bothered under any circumstances. So just like whatever happens to these kids, he's just like, fuck it. I can't be bothered. So as I said, there's the implication being some of the things that he says, like his, you know, my life in London like amuses me, but it's nothing for children. So some people have speculated that, you know, because he's a bachelor, you know, maybe he's, you know, that was maybe coded gay, or maybe he's just like a, you know, he could just be like this man whore that's just like going around hitting every woman in town and partying all the time, which, you know, it could mean that too. But whatever the case, he got saddled with these two kids and he's not having it. So he just wants some woman to come in and take care of these kids and take care of this country estate that he has and just like not ever bother him with it ever. Opening scene is very interesting because, like I said, it kind of lays out a bunch of stuff. It's almost kind of like she's kind of like, look, I've never had a governess job before. Are you not worried about that? And he's like, no, you know, I just need a person to do this. And I think you're that person. And it's almost like there's a little bit of like flirtation going on, at least more from her end. She seems a little coquettish, like, you know, and like I said, I don't know if that's me reading into it, but I don't know. So like some interpretations have kind of showed that maybe she has like some weird sexual repression going on or something like that. Or like I said, maybe she was like very sheltered because she apparently grew up in a religious household, whatever it was. And so she hasn't been out and about in the world, even though she's a little bit older. So there's all kind of stuff going on there. So after this first scene, so she gets the job and she goes out to this massive country estate, obviously Bly Manor, where the kids have been staying. Now, at first, only Flora is there. She's like the younger little girl. And Miles is off, who's a little bit older. I think he's supposed to be 12, although he seems a tiny bit younger, but I can't, it's hard for me to tell, but I think he's like supposed to be 12 in the movie. And I think Flora's supposed to be like a little bit younger, maybe like 9 or 10 or something like that. And Miles is away at boarding school. So Miss Giddens gets to this place and it seems idyllic. It's a massive, massive place. It's, you know, all the interiors I think were filmed in Shepperton Studios, but the exteriors were filmed in this big like Gothic mansion in East Sussex. I think they did some Hammer movies there as well, if I'm not mistaken. So she gets there, Flora's there, and there's also Mrs. Gross, who's like kind of a kindly old housekeeper. And there's also a couple other kind of staff members that you don't really see much, like a gardener and a cook and stuff like that, who are kind of mentioned, but you don't really see them. Now, when Miss Giddens first gets there and she meets Flora, who's played by Pamela Franklin, by the way, this was actually her first film role. And she would go on to be, well, I know her from Legend of Hell House in the 70s. Where she was just like cute as a bug in that one too, but obviously she's a woman then, but she's a little girl and she's great in this. Cause you know, it's always kind of like child actors are always very, very hit or miss. The kids in this are great. They're great because depending on what your interpretation of the film is, like how you're reading it, how you're coming at it, you could either see their behavior as really, really creepy, or you could just see them as like kids being kids, or maybe, you know, they're kind of troubled, but not acting all that unusual. So it's really kind of like a really nuanced, layered kind of performance, which you don't see a lot from child actors. And actually the kid that plays Miles, I think his name's Martin Stevens. He had been in a couple movies before. He was in Village of the Damned, for example. And he's also fantastic in this, in what is a very, I mean, I would imagine was like kind of a difficult role for a child to play because, and I'll get into this in a bit, there's a little bit of weird sexual tension. I know it's like a weird thing to say, it's about a kid in a movie, but That's it, kind of like goes in with some of the interpretations of this film. So she first meets Flora, the little girl, and Flora is just like a charming, enchanting little girl, and she's just, Miss Giddens just over the moon. She's like, not only is this house and these gardens fantastic and more, and you know, she says later that she grew up, like I said, her dad was like a parson, so she grew up in a very small house, and so this is like the lap of luxury, you know. And it's also kind of implied that one of the things she says in the interview is that she loves children like more than anything else. And it's almost kind of like the way she says it, there's always something like a little bit weird about it. You know what I mean? That's kind of like her, I don't know, just like her face. There's just like weird shit. There's all kind of these weird little subtle hints and insinuations that you could read lots of different ways, which, like I said, which is why I think this movie is so brilliant and why people still talk about it and like about all the different interpretations of it. So she's enchanted by Flora, and you know, and basically Flora's like, oh, you know, Miles is coming, and she's like, no, he's not coming home till the holidays, he's at boarding school. But then, like, the next day, they get this letter in the mail, which actually had first gone to their uncle in London, but the uncle, typically, hadn't even opened it, and just forwarded it back to the house, because again, he just didn't want to be bothered. So the letter is from Miles' school, and basically says, we're expelling him. And they don't really say why. They imply that something like he's a bad influence or something like that, but they don't really give any specifics. And at this point, Miss Giddens is just kind of like, well, what could he have done? And Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper who knows Miles, she's like, that can't be right. It's like, he's just a charming child. He would never do anything bad. He's not a bad kid. You know, it's like kind of like he's spirited. I think she says that, but you know, he wouldn't do anything like to get him expelled. They must have made a mistake. So they go and pick up Miles from the train, and at first, indeed, it does kind of seem like, what on earth could this angelic child have ever done to get himself expelled, of all things? He comes across as very, very charming, very mature for his age, and again, maybe, a little bit too mature, because he still comes across like a kid, but the way he talks very much like an adult, and he almost has like a weird, like flirtatious kind of thing. So like even when they're going back to Bly Manor at the beginning, he's very flattering toward Miss Giddens, who's obviously, you know, old enough to be his mother. And, you know, he's so, you're much too pretty to, you know, to do this and that. And she kind of like makes a joke about it, like chides him about it. You're much too young to talk like such a flattering deceiver, she says. Right from the jump, you're getting this weird, uncomfortable. I don't know if it's like, it is a little bit uncomfortable, but it's supposed to be. You know what I'm saying? Because there's, like I said, there's a lot of weird shit going on in this movie. So, but at first, everything seems, like, pretty cool. Like, the kids are delightful, and Miss Giddens is just having a whale of a time, you know, hanging out with these two kids. Because they're, like I said, they're very charming, they're intelligent, and they're just, like, a lot of fun to be around. They're just delightful, delightful children. However, as the time goes on, just little things start getting to Miss Giddens. The kids, while charming and intelligent and wonderful, occasionally seem to have little quirks, and they also seem real secretive. Like, they seem like they're always whispering to one another and kind of going off together and doing stuff, and it seems like they're up to something, you know what I mean? Just not overtly, and it doesn't seem malicious, but she just thinks it's a little strange. And then, as time goes on a little further, Miss Giddens starts to see things. Now, the first thing she sees, she's out cutting roses in the garden one day, and she looks up toward, like, the roof, you know, or the turret or whatever, and she sees what she's pretty sure is the figure of a man. Now, it's very foggy, and then there's kind of sun slanting in her eyes, but she's like, she's pretty sure that that's a man, but she can't really tell what he looks like. So she runs up there to the turret, and it turns out that Miles is up there, because that's where he keeps his pigeons. And she's like, well, how long have you been up here? And he says, I've been up here for like half an hour. She's like, well, you must have seen the guy that was up here. There was a guy. And she's like, no, there was no guy up here. I've been up here. And, you know, she's like, no, he was right here like 2 minutes ago. And he said, well, maybe it was me that you saw. And she's like, no, it was a man. So she was just insistent that she saw a figure. So she asked Mrs. Gross, you know, are there other people living in this house that I don't know about, you know, other than the kids and the couple other crew members, or, you know, the other people that work there? And she's like, no, there's nobody else here. Maybe you just were seeing things, or maybe you're tired or something like that. And then as a little more time goes by, like one night, her and the kids, it's like their bedtime, but they just decide they want to play hide and seek. So she decides to play with them. And she finds this, she goes up in the attic and she finds this music box that plays this tune. It's actually called Oh Willow Whaley. And it plays this tune that Flora is always like humming and singing all the time. Like sometimes she'll be like looking out the window, like humming it. And it's like this really creepy, like haunting kind of tune that she's always singing. And the words are kind of creepy too, like about laying down under the weeping willow and dying and stuff. So, you know, so that's a little unsettling. So she finds that, and then she finds this this picture that's in this music box of a guy, and it's kind of like the glass is cracked. So she's kind of looking at it going, huh, I wonder who that is. And the kids pop out. And at this point, like Miles kind of pops out like, oh, you wouldn't have found me if I hadn't popped out. And then he like puts his arm around her neck and he's like kind of strangling her. And she's just like, haha, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, you're hurting me. And the way he reacts is very strange. Like it's kind of like age inappropriate. It's almost kind of like he's doing it sort of like he acts more toward her like a lover than a kid, you know what I mean? It's more like a, which, like I said, it's a very uncomfortable dynamic, but it's supposed to be, because, you know, it leads into like one of the interpretations, whether the ghosts are real or not, we don't really know. So at that point, like after that, they're like, okay, well, you know, Miss Giddens, she has to go hide now. So she goes and hides, and she hides behind like this curtain down in the drawing room or whatever. And then when she looks out the window, she sees a man. Like she sees, it looks like the same man, you know, that she saw up on the turret, but obviously she sees his face like really up close. Like the dude is just like looking in the window, and she flips the fuck out. So she starts screaming, and Mrs. Gross comes down. She's like, I saw this guy like out the window. He was like staring in the window. And she describes him, and she's like, oh, there's a picture of him up in the attic. I saw it earlier. And, you know, when she describes who it looks like, and Mrs. Gross is being like, well, that sounds like Peter Quint. He was the valet, like, for the master, the uncle, when he used to live here. And she's like, well, yeah, that must be who it is. And she's like, yeah, but that dude's dead. And so then, you know, obviously Miss Giddens is like, well, shit, that can't be. So then at this point, Miss Giddens starts kind of pressing for more history about what happened. Now, she did know, like, I think even the first scene, like the interview, I think she did know that the governess who's, you know, who she's replacing, Miss Jessel, Mary Jessel, that she had actually died, although that's all that anybody told her. They just said, oh, her and Flora were very close, and so Flora was like really traumatized when Miss Jessel died, because, you know, she loved her. So, you know, don't bring it up. Basically, they told her, like, don't talk about Miss Jessel to Flora because it upsets her. Now, so what we know now is that not only is Miss Jessel dead, but there was also this other valet dude that hung out that used to work there who's also dead. And Mrs. Gross says, yeah, he just basically, all they know is that they think that he came home and he was probably drunk one night, and it was like out in the dark, like in the middle of winter, and it looked like he slipped on the stairs and like busted his head open and died. And she said, yeah, Miles found him, and like his eyes were open, and Miles was like really upset and everything. But it is hinted that maybe somebody could have like whacked him in the head and killed him, because she's like, yeah, he was kind of like somebody that maybe somebody would want to do that to. So again, that's also left ambiguous. Did he die accidentally? Did somebody murder him? They never solve that, but it could go either way. And then it comes to light as Miss Giddens gets more and more obsessed with the history of this and starting to see apparitions. She also sees who she presumes is Miss Jessel, like wearing a black dress, and she sees her like in kind of in the reeds, like across the lake. And so she starts getting into, like, Mrs. Gross reveals that, well, what was going on was that Peter Quint and Miss Jessel were in a sexual relationship, and it was also a very abusive relationship. And Mrs. Gross basically says, and everything, like I said, is everything is like implication, but basically what she says, without coming out and saying this outright, is that Peter Quint and Miss Jessel would basically just use some of the unused rooms, and they just like go in there and fuck and like not care if people saw them. And apparently she saw them like several times, and maybe the kids saw them too. but no one's really sure about that. So there's all this going on. And she said, yeah, what basically happened, she said it was really pitiful to watch because Miss Jessel, even though Peter Quint was like a total shithead and like smacked her around and was like horrible to her, treated her like a dog, she would just like do anything for him and just like follow him around everywhere. And then after he died, she basically... See, at first, Mrs. Gross says, well, she died of a broken heart. But then later, she says, no, she drowned herself. She jumped in the lake and drowned herself. So there's this whole, like, history going on. Now, from these fragments, Miss Giddens, and from that, you know, history that she learns piece by piece, and the fact that the kids are, like, act a little weird in the sense that, like, sometimes Flora, she's always, like, humming that song and, like, staring out the window and there's, like, nobody out there, presumably. She kind of goes off on her own sometimes and she looks like she's dancing by herself. And Mrs. Gross says at one point, like, you know, her Flora and Miss Jessel used to dance together all the time. You know, so that was something that they did. And from the fact of Miles acting more like an adult than a kid and acting like almost like flirtatiously toward Miss Giddens, even though, like I said, she's old enough to be his mother. Like, he calls her my dear and he acts very much like an adult. And at one point she's talking to him about why he got expelled from school and he won't really tell her outright. He's kind of very evasive about it, but then he starts acting really like charming and everything. And he basically straight up like kisses her right on the mouth. And it's just this really uncomfortable. And then she kind of backs off and like this face that she makes is just, you're not really sure how to read it. Cause she's just like, is she shocked? Is she grossed out? Is she turned on weirdly? It's just like this, it's so, so weird. And like I said, it's such a great layered performance. It's such a layered script that you could just like interpret it in lots of different ways. So from all of these sort of tendrils and from, you know, Miss Giddens seeing the apparitions, even though nobody else seems to see them, but she becomes convinced that the children do see them and are just lying about it to fuck with her. And she also suspects that maybe Mrs. Gross can see them too and is maybe just in denial. But then she's also kind of thinking, well, maybe I am the only one that sees them, so maybe I'm going crazy. And all this is kind of like, none of this is really spelled out, but you can tell that that's kind of what's going on just from like the actions and from her face and everything like that. She's not entirely sure if other people are seeing them too. But as it goes on, she becomes convinced that the ghosts of Peter Quint and Miss Jessel are basically still in the house and are possessing the children in order that they can carry on their physical relationship. So you can imagine the implications of that, like a very, you know, a 12-year-old boy and his, you know, 9, 10-year-old sister maybe being possessed by, you know, an abusive couple. And so you're not entirely sure if that's what's going on or if Miss Giddens is just kind of making this all up or is projecting her own repressed sexuality or her own like kind of fucked up sexual desires or fantasies like onto these kids. So it's never made clear whether the kids actually are possessed, whether they actually see the ghosts too, or whether Miss Giddens is just losing her goddamn mind. And it has been, there's a lot of Freudian stuff in here too, which I'm sure like Truman Capote put that in there too. But there's also been some interpretations as well that Miss Giddens is kind of like a pedophile and she kind of has the hots for Miles, but doesn't want to admit that to herself because of her religious upbringing. And there's all this kind of like guilt and everything. And she doesn't want to, she's like in denial about it. So it's almost kind of like she invents this whole thing. It's like, oh, well, it's okay because he's possessed by the spirit of an older man. So he's not really a kid. Because there is one point where she has a line. It's not about Miles. It's actually about Flora. But she says to Mrs. Gross at one point, she's like, well, at times Flora isn't a child. She's an old, old woman. So, and like I said, I really think it was the absolute correct decision to leave it ambiguous as to whether these ghosts were real and were possessing these kids and corrupting them, you know, which could be the case, Or it could be the case that Miss Giddens got these little bits of information over the course of the movie from different people and is sort of spinning that into this web of fantasy about these ghosts possessing these two kids because she can't deal with her own feelings about it. And again, I think that's why that was a good decision to leave her backstory largely unexplored. There are just a couple of things she says. Like I said, you know, she does have seem to have a religious upbringing. And interestingly, too, one of the first, I think it might be the first image of the film, is her praying and how she all she wants to do is save the children. Because at some point, she is so convinced that these kids are possessed by these spirits that she basically comes to the thing. She's like, I'm going to do anything to save them from being corrupted by these evil, monstrous spirits, is how she sees them. So could it be that there are no ghosts at all, and that she's just this, you know, this repressed religious, she actually believes that these innocent children are demonically possessed because she can't, like I said, deal with her own weird repression and her own like weird sexual, possible sexual feelings toward them. And like I said, is there some kind of thing in her past that is not ever explained, why she has this particular, because like I said, there, even at the very beginning in that first scene in the, when she's at the interview, when she's talking about how that's the most important thing, like children are, she loves it more than anything, but the way she says it and like her facial expression is just very, very weird. So there's that whole thing too. But as I said, if you want to interpret it as the ghosts are real, you could totally do that too. It works either way, because there are a couple of scenes, one scene in particular, which honestly is one of the best ones because it's like one of the creepiest ones in the whole movie, where Miss Giddens and Flora are out kind of on the, in this gazebo or whatever, and Miss Giddens sees the ghost of Miss Jessel, like in her black dress, like across the lake, like standing in the weeds. And she is absolutely convinced, as Flora, you see her too. And Flora, for a second, like she's looking out over the lake and they just show Flora's face. And for a second, it does look like she's seeing the ghost too. And then she kind of like crinkles her brow and then turns toward her and she's like, I don't, what are you talking about? I don't see anything. But it's interesting because Miss Giddens, basically, she doesn't say, oh, there's somebody standing there. She says, over there, over there. And then Flora is just looking exactly right where the ghost of Miss Jessel is supposed to be. And for a second, you're kind of like, yeah, she sees her too. But then she totally denies it. And then she starts flipping out, saying, like, Miss Giddens, she's scaring me to death. I don't see anything. I don't see anything. And then later on, when she's talking to Mrs. Gross, Mrs. Gross said, yeah, I didn't see anything either. But see, at that point, Miss Giddens is so convinced that she sees them that she thinks everybody is lying to her. So could it be that she's paranoid? Could it be that, yes, they are seeing the ghost, but they're in denial? Because there is a scene very, very early on in the movie where Flora says something about Mrs. Gross. They hear this weird noise outside, and Flora says, Mrs. Gross says we should just pretend not to hear it because then you don't imagine things. So could it be that Mrs. Gross is completely aware that the house is haunted, but has just learned to kind of live with it by going, nope, you know, and just like shutting it all out? So that could be a possibility as well. So like I said, if you want to read it as just kind of like Miss Giddens is nuts and she just used these little bits of information that she got from everybody and just constructed this edifice of craziness that these kids were possessed and that nothing supernatural was going on at all, or she could be totally correct and the house is haunted, and she's perceiving it and everyone else is seeing it too, but they're in denial about it. So there could be that whole thing too. Also, there might be, this is also maybe an implication, that Miles might have been sexually abused by Peter Quint. Again, it's not spelled out explicitly, but you could totally read it that way too. And that's why he's acting like an adult. That's what I mean. It's like, it's, you could say that, yeah, him acting that way, you know, him being possessed by Peter Quint would cause him to act that way. But it could also be that because when Peter Quint was alive, Miles hung out with him and Peter Quint was a douche, like an abusive jerk. And so maybe he picked up like all this precocious sexual behavior from Peter Quint from hanging out with him all the time. And because Peter Quint had died, which was very traumatic for him because they were very, very close. Miss Jessel had died, also traumatic. Miles is very aware that their uncle doesn't give a shit about them and doesn't care if they live or die, so also very traumatic. And it turned out later, too, that the thing that got Miles expelled from school, they don't explicitly say what it is, but Miles basically admits that was trying to, he scared the other kids at school by basically like creeping around in the dark. And he says, "I hurt things," meaning maybe he abused animals, and he seemed, maybe he hurt some of the other kids. They never say exactly what he did, but it was clearly something bad enough that he said and did something bad enough that they thought that he was a corrupting influence on the other kids. But like I said, that doesn't necessarily mean he was possessed. That could just mean that the influence of Peter Quint when he was alive had caused the kid to act out, and then like the death would cause that kid to act out. But like I said, that's the best thing about this movie is that you could totally read it either way. Totally supernatural, or totally psychological, and you would honestly be right either way, because either way, it completely works, and I think that's an amazing achievement in screenwriting. I mean, it's incredible. So initially, they were going to, I guess Jack Clayton, who, this is totally crazy, but I had picked, like, a bunch of movies to do for this week, and one of the ones that I picked that I'm probably going to put up tomorrow is also directed by Jack Clayton, and I totally had forgotten about that, and I totally did not do that on purpose. So I didn't even mean to do two Jack Clayton movies in the same week, but, you know, happy accidents. It happens that way sometimes. I was just picking movies that I said, oh yeah, I gotta do that one. Oh yeah, I gotta do that one. And yeah, it just kind of turned out. But yeah, so initially, he wanted to shoot it just in like the regular aspect ratio, but then whatever, like the studio, I guess, they wanted him to do it in CinemaScope, and he was just kind of like, well, I don't know what I'm gonna do with that, because there's going to be like all this room on the edge of the frame and I don't really know what to do with it. But then they brought in cinematographer Freddie Francis, who had some ideas about what to do with the edges of the frame. And the framing and the shot composition and stuff like that in this is just, it's beautiful. And every single, like, I've seen so many analyses of this movie, not only from like a psychological supernatural standpoint, but also from a filmmaking standpoint, like the way it's edited, like the shot compositions, you know, and all of this stuff, like, you know, the way the shots are composited together, the length of the shots, and arguing that that is also suggestive of different interpretations of the film. But just basically go on YouTube and put, like, The Innocents 1961 analysis or whatever, and there's, like, a whole bunch of really good ones. I can't get into too much stuff, and I don't want to, like, you know, step on someone else's dick with their content or whatever, but there's, like, a lot of really good ones, like, talking about, you know, the various edits, and particularly in that first scene, I saw this great video where a guy was breaking down the first interview scene and kind of talking about like the way the shots were framed and how everyone was standing and stuff and how it might be indicative of certain interpretations of the film. But it's like really, really, it's really awesome. But I think that that's why people still remember this movie, even though it's, you know, came out in 1961. And so it's just kind of like one of those films that it's just timeless because, and like I said, that's why there have been so many recent interpretations of it as well, just because this is such, it's such a timeless story that you could read pretty much whatever you want into it. And as I said, I'm sure that Stanley Kubrick used this as an influence on The Shining, because it really does have a lot of parallels with that story. You know, the whole isolated location, the whole starting out with an interview that is kind of like indicative of larger themes, you know, them going out and this kid, and it's like nobody really knowing if we're seeing ghosts or if it's just, you know, Jack Torrance losing his shit or whatever it is. So this is kind of like the same kind of thing. Interestingly too, I think at the time this came out, like many great horror movies before and since, it got mixed reviews when it first came out in 1961. And some reviews thought that it leaned too hard into Miss Giddens, you know, Deborah Carr's character being crazy, you know, and all of it being in her imagination. I don't agree with that. I actually think you could read it completely either way, and I think that was completely deliberate. And the way that Jack Clayton made the movie, I mean, he specifically went into it saying, I don't want to come down on one side or the other. I want to be able to read it in both ways, and they're both like legitimate, and I think it was really successful in doing that. So if you've never seen The Innocents, for Christ's sake, if you're into horror movies at all, if you're into ghost stories at all, this is easily the best adaptation of Turn of the Screw. You know, like I said, Haunting of Bly Manor was pretty great, but that's not really, I don't know if I'd consider that a straight adaptation, because obviously it's a massive expansion on it. It's kind of sad because, you know, 2019, when The Turning came out, we saw it in the theater, and at first I was kind of like, this is pretty good. So obviously it's not as good as The Innocents, but I was like, oh, this is pretty good. But then at the end, they just leaned right into, yeah, she was crazy the whole time. And I just thought that was a stupid way to end it. They should have just left it open-ended. It's much, much better that way. But I don't know. There's a certain class of filmmaker, and there's a certain class of film audience that don't like things left to interpretation. They're just like, well, which one was it? Were the ghosts real, or were they, you know, that's the point. The point is the ambiguity. And it's not ambiguous in the sense that it's not clear. It's just that ambiguous in the sense that it could go either way, and it inspires debate. And I think that's really something that film should be doing, because it's like, if you go see a movie and nobody wants to talk about it afterward, then it wasn't all that successful, was it? And people are still talking about this film nowadays, so obviously Jack Clayton did something right. But yeah, so I'm not sure. I think you can see this. I don't know where it's streaming at the moment. Like I said, I got this on Amazon. I think it was like $5 or something like that. And this is a very, very bare bones release, sadly. It's not even like in the widescreen. Like, the first part of it's in the widescreen, but then it goes into the other aspect ratio, and there are no special features on it other than a trailer, which is a shame. I'll get a better one at some point. I mean, there's got to be a Criterion Collection, you would kind of think. But, you know, I'm sure you can find it someplace. And it's a classic. If you haven't seen it, you really should. So please go see it. We'll talk about it in the comments. And I will see you guys on the next Halloween Eek Week movie retrospective Halloween Week special. Bye.